The best thing about being a teen girl is getting to have a cowgirl summer. Oh, this is the Pure Boys, a Christian podcast, but God told us to change. So for the summer we're watching cowgirl flicks. Get in the action, feel the attraction. Horses and teens, oh, what a dream. I wanna be free and free to ride some horses.
Man, I feel like a cowgirl.
This is our summer theme song.
Yeah. Ciao, Fudgepackers. Welcome to Pure Boys Podcast. John Voight Summer, why not? I'm Adam and Urine.
And it's all urine to me. Wash it over Steve, whomst I am.
Beautifully put. You're like Madonna in A League of Their Own with how much you love urine.
But with words and urine.
Exactly. Beautiful. Much completely unlike Madonna in that sense.
Oh, but much like God in that sense, because he was talking about pee and writing his good book. All over the place for yes.
Oh, yeah. Speaking of God and yes, we're talking about 2014's Deadly Lessons or 2006's The Legend of Simon Conjurer. You and IMDb be the judge on what this movie is and when it was released.
Which kind of holds true to the whole movie. You don't know what's going on. What's a dream? What's reality? Who's the conjurer? Who's John Voight? I don't think I even saw him in this.
Well, he is in this, and his grubby little chocolate-covered fingerprints are all over this movie, because this movie reeks of nepotism and all kinds of shady shenanigans. But, it's John Voight Summer, week two. Well, week seven, I guess, technically. Week six, I guess, technically.
Technically, I don't want to get into the film, obviously, but I will say that this movie is basically the worst of humanity put into a film.
Yeah, when you think of the disgustingness of Hollywood, this movie should be played in This movie should be played on every screen in your Hummer. That's for sure.
Oh yeah, multiple screens, multiple Hummers. go out and spend money, people.
Oh yeah, in this economy, go out and spend that money, honey. Before we get to everything we have to talk about in this episode, we of course need to do the Pure Boys prayer.
God bless our podcast, please. Oh, should we start over?
Sure, let's do it again.
Yeah. God bless our podcast, please.
Should we start again?
Yeah.
All right. God
bless our podcast, please. God bless all podcasts, please. We love you, please.
Amen.
Amen.
Or amen.
How have we not been saying that, or have we?
Oh, I've been saying it every week, yeah, since JTG taught me it.
Yeah, to all the females out there, respect.
Hey, respect your neck, big up yourselves.
Bumbleclod, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, blah, 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 you understand, Chet Hanks, yeah. Before we get too far into this episode, it's of course John Voight Summer, why not? And I just got a question for you, and it's not the question that you think I might ask, but it's the question that I have been asking all summer, and that is, what you drinking this week, big fella?
Well, I got home after reminding myself so many times to go out and get a bottle of wine after work, but I did not heed these remembrances and just came straight home. Furiously started texting my wife and asking her if I can open these bottles of wine, which I could not because themselves are remembrances of our wedding. So I had to go out and get a bottle of wine. And I, of course, grabbed a Barefoot Merlot. It's from California.
Oh, beautiful. Tell me a little bit about that wine. What is how is his body? Is it a BBW?
Well, let's see if it gives me the body. I would have to assume it's medium if it says anything about the body, but it says the perfect combination of blueberry, boysenberry, and plum notes.
Ooh.
Raised right, it's well-rounded and ready to bring home.
Oh, that actually sounds quite good. I like the blueberry, boysenberry, and plum. That sounds like a good combination. And it was raised right.
Blueberry, so, boysenberry, and plum.
As opposed to being raised left.
Yeah, but they're only notes. Yeah, raised right.
Correct. Just for the listener, Steve is holding the bottle as if he's sending me a picture of his penis. It's held quite low in the frame, and he's gripping the base of the bottle and holding it up as if he's trying to send me a picture of his jimmies. How's it smell?
It smells terrible. I can
that's wine.
Smell the acid that they definitely poured right in.
Oh, yeah, delicious. He's taking a big whiff.
But as my nose is getting used to it, I'm definitely getting a lot of that boysenberry, blueberry, and shall I say raspberry notes?
I don't think you shall. I think you should say plum. I don't think there's any. If you're getting raspberry, you're drinking the wrong wine, or they mislabeled it.
Wine, as I'm told, is very subjective, so I wanted to throw my own berry in there, but I'm definitely getting plum, too.
We know.
Chocolate, some vanilla, caramel notes, of course, ooh. Rubber tire in the nose.
It's got an oaky afterbirth. It's just delicious.
Mm-hmm.
All right, take a
sip. I'm going to pour it.
You know, you were going to drink right from the bottle. I want to see you drink from the bottle.
Well, I'll drink from the bottle. Sure.
Yeah, just for that first sip, let me know how it tastes.
Yeah, it's crap.
Tastes like an old foot, like a bare foot.
Yeah, like a bare foot. I think this comes from California, right?
Mm-hmm.
I was gonna say Australia, and then I realized on the front it says California in big block letters.
Well, and that's the section of the wine area you got it from was California.
California, straight from the horse's mouth.
Mm.
Most awarded.
What? Academy Awards.
Wine brand.
Junos. Country Music Awards.
Yeah, I think
Awards.
This got a lot of Junos from Haiti.
They love it out in Haiti.
Who wouldn't? Beautiful sky.
Oh.
Tall mountains. So everywhere looks like winter.
Mm-hmm. It's beautiful. Well, thank you so much for asking about what I'm drinking this week. Because I, of course, am finishing off this delicious box of Peller Family Vineyards Cabernet Sauvignon. It's complex, it's medium-bodied, and it has a smooth finish. Over 50 years and 4 generations have brewed this wine to perfection and slapped it in a dirty old Camelback bag, and now it's certainly turned to vinegar, and I'm going to be finishing the box tonight, because why not? Let's pour that first glass and dome it.
Now, Adam, what are you drinking this week?
Oh, thanks so much for asking, Steve. I'm drinking a full-bodied Peller Family Cabernet Sauvignon. Uh-oh, we're getting running low.
It's kind of tough and kind of weird that we need each other's wine, because I want to compare a well-bodied to a full-bodied or a medium-bodied.
This is a I should know. I read it every week. This is a medium-bodied, but it's got a smooth finish.
Mine's a well-bodied, so it's a bit more rounder to the taste.
What in the hell does any of that mean? What is bodied when it comes to wine? Explain to me. I know the tannins. I know that that's a word, but how does that relate to the body?
I think it's how it sits in your mouth, how unctuous it is.
Oh, well, when you just guzzle it down like a greedy little pig and it fills your belly, you don't have time to enjoy the mouthfeel of a beautiful Peller Family Cabernet. Speaking of which... Oh, go ahead. What were you going to say?
I want you to take a sip of it, but that goes against every fiber of your being, so chug it, lug. Go with it.
It's got a little vinegar in it this week, but that's good. That's what you want in a good wine. So, hey, cheers to you, and John Voight Summer, why not?
Why not? I'm going to have a sip as well, but I'm definitely not going to chug my first glass. Oh, that seemed faster than the last.
Oh, ho, ho. Ooh, those tannins are spicy this week. If I could describe what a 6-week-old box of wine tastes like, I'd say spicy around the outside. It's gonna burn coming out.
Yeah, it's got a spicy body.
Oh, it certainly does have a spicy body.
Philip, I am so proud of you. I've never been prouder of a human being than I am in this moment. because you stuck to your guns and you chugged that first glass of wine and nobody wanted you to.
That's true. Not even my wife. Nobody did. Let's see how much is left. I filled up my second glass. Let me just get a good look at it here. Oh, there's still like at least a glass left in there. Well, I'll save that for my wife for later. She can have that.
Yeah, that's a good glass that you have left.
It's
that
fruity.
You'll definitely have to drink during this podcast.
It's definitely very fruity, and I'll give it that. Well, hey, bottoms up. Time to dome a second. Just kidding. I'm not going to dome a second. Well, should I dome a second glass? I'm really...
I wouldn't. Yeah. I need you copacetic for this deadly lessons chat, because I let this movie wash over me like a sack of bricks.
I mean, me too. Well, what a movie it was. And what a John Voight summer it's been. And I guess now it's time to let the listeners in on a little fact about John Voight summer. This is the end of John Voight summer and the temporary end of Pure Boys, because I got a job in a city far away from where I live. And I will not be able to take my recording equipment with me, so we have to put this show on ice, if you will, until October, when we will return gallantly and valiantly. But for now, this is it, Michael Jackson.
And don't you worry out there, we're definitely never going to watch anything other than John Voight movies from now on, so... Yeah. You will definitely get your John Voight picks when we come back.
Of course. Until next summer when we do Burt Reynolds summer. Because I was looking into Burt Reynolds' filmography, and he has so many great movies under his belt. He's got The Smokies and the Bandits 1 through 3. He's got Cannonball Runs 1 and 2. He's got a movie called Gator, where I think he plays a stuntman. He's got Booger Nights. He's got All Dogs Go to Heaven. Just endless hit after hit. The Longest Yard, original and remake. Just endless hits for whatever his name is. Squirt Reynolds.
Well, I guess the happiest part of this for me is I get to send a big up yours to PureFlix and not give them money anymore for a little while.
Yeah, that's going to be really nice. It's going to save you some buckas.
Yeah, and I'll, you know, chip in for the hosting. People need to hear this.
They need to know how we handle our finances. I, of course, pay for the podcast hosting. Steve pays for the PureFlix subscription, and that costs him an arm and a leg. And we haven't watched PureFlix in months, so he's paying for nothing right now, and will be paying for nothing for the next 3 months. So unless you want to keep it and, you know, keep abreast of all the great PureFlix original TV series that are coming out.
I'll just check on Twitter. I'll just see what David A.R. White is tweeting and PureFlix is tweeting and whoever kind of monitors their Twitter.
That's
I'm guessing like people on the moon.
People on the moon. People in hell. I had to turn this fan off for a bit, but it's way too hot in my studio. I got to turn this fan back on. Can you hear the fan over the speaker or over the microphone?
Well, let's get a clean like 10 seconds and okay. I'll see if I can hear
it. Here
it
is. Probably fine.
I think you're good.
All right, perfect. Well, we can cut it out because of that. Oh, God.
Where do you have the fan? Do you have it, like, directly up your nards?
Yeah, of course, yeah, in my Tony Nardies. Now, if we would have watched Frank D'Angelo's movies, you would have known and loved who Tony Nardi was, but that's all right. There's always next summer when we do Frank D'Angelo summer.
As I thought I would think, Frank D'Angelo, not for me.
That's fair.
Also for me, though. I get the appeal.
Yeah, he's an acquired taste, much like a delicious barefoot blueberry wine.
I love his endings.
Oh, solid, right? And his movies are full of great endings. But, well, you know what? No need to tease a future that may or may not happen, much like Terminator 2. We need to get to everyone's favorite segment. No, we need to ask a very important question. And that is, of course, a question that we ask every week, but we'll be taking, like, 12 weeks off from asking this question. That, of course, is, Steve, whomst was the Bagger Vance of Deliverance? Ooh, I couldn't remember what we watched last week for a second there.
But yeah, you made it, and you made it in spades.
Thank you.
No, you can't say that anymore.
You can. Nobody can. As long as you say David Spades or Kate Spades, rest in peace.
David, thank you very much. I always end with David Spades. There was limited characters in this movie. There's the big, fat, stupid river. There's also government damming up water, which is cool. But for the Baker Vance of Deliverance, I of course have to go with John Boy.
Oh, beautiful choice. And couldn't be more correct in that sense. Yeah. Why John Voight? What is it about him that's so perfect for a Bagger Vance?
Well, he has to succumb to the beta to Burt Reynolds' alpha. Mm. And I think that's the signature of the perfect Will Smith beta cuck man.
Yeah, fair enough. I should have asked whom's was the anaconda of Deliverance, but here we are too deep into the segment to change now.
Well, Ned Beatty, of course. Now, Adam,
yes.
Whoops, do you think was the Bagger Vance of a little film known as Deliverance?
Well, Steve, thank you so much for asking. To me, the Bagger Vance of Deliverance was, of course, the big fat river, which gave us the big spooky spook at the end where the hand popped out and was the crux of this whole movie. Oh boy, we're running out of time. And was the carried us along our journey through all the unpleasantness. The end.
What a dumb river, eh?
Just a big fat stupid idiot of a river. Hey, speaking of big fat stupid idiots, it's time to get to everyone's favorite segment of the week.
The Kevin Sorbo Tweet of the Week.
Kevin!
Well, Kevin Sorbo, he's having a tough time with the old poop shoot because he pushed this one out at 10:56 a.m. on July 4th. 2022.
Hey.
He should be getting the barbecue ready.
Well, maybe he was. Maybe that's what he calls going to the bathroom, is I just gotta go get the barbecue ready.
Degrease it.
Right. I gotta throw some briquettes in the barbecue, is what he says.
So, I thought I'd go with the classic tweet on July 4th. So, his is happy 4th! !! Space! Line break! God bless the USA! !! And that's it.
Oh, no comments on how Joe Biden feels about America? Because I heard from a very good source last year that Joe Biden hates America.
He does hate America, but I think Joe Biden like dressed up in a bunch of flags and old white beard to signify he's Colonel Washington. And so you can't make fun of him on July 4th.
That's what they call him, Colonel Washington. I want you, Colonel Washington.
Well, before he was a man that had slaves, he was a colonel.
That's true. And boy, did he have... He had so many slaves. Oh, my God. I can't express how many slaves Colonel Washington had. It was uncountable, you might say.
Baker's dozen, at least.
Oh, yeah. They called that a General Washington's dozen. It's 14. Yeah.
But then the FBI got involved, and they had to whitewash everything.
Yeah. And then Tammy Faye Baker came along, and she had some slaves, and they were like, you know what? We're going to give it to her. Baker's dozen. Those are hers.
Yeah, give it to her.
Yeah.
Lock her up.
Oh, man. Amen to that. Why wasn't that his tweet? Happy 4th of July. #. Lock her up.
Benghazi, she did it. She did the worst.
Never forget, Hillary Clinton doesn't celebrate 4th of July. She celebrates Benghazi Day when she did the thing she did in Benghazi, which I don't even know what that is.
No, but she did it.
She did
for
it.
For sure.
Hey, if there's one thing I can say for sure, it's that she did it.
Yeah, I think instead of lock her up, we should change it to she did it.
That's a great call. She did it. Guilty as charged. You know, you remember that tune?
Yeah. I do remember that tune, and I think it applies perfectly to Hillary Clinton.
Perfect. Well, happy 4th of July. We are recording this on the 4th of July, weirdly enough. By the time this episode airs, I will be starting my new job on the day before, I guess. So, hey, congrats to me.
So you get to take a train.
Yeah.
Do you get to like chill out and just like have a day to yourself before you start your job?
Yes.
Or is it like next day?
No, actually I do. I take the train on Friday. I get there Saturday evening. I have to find a ride to the place, which is about 45 minutes away. But then once I get there, I have all of Sunday just to hang out, maybe ride some dirt bikes or something, go and eat some delicious grub, and then start my job on Monday. So as someone who took a train on a very similar path from on the path that I'm taking a train, how do you feel about that? Did you enjoy your train ride when you came out to the place that we live together?
No, it was an absolute disaster.
Oh,
it was it was almost 24 hours late, which would probably not be good for you.
Oh boy, that sucks. How was a train late?
It was very cramped, like taking a bus. Like it was just a car that was filled with people and people right beside me, and it wasn't more comfortable than a bus whatsoever. Did you get yourself a room though?
No.
Obviously a very luxurious room.
No, God, I got the cheapest ticket available because I'm moving out there to make money. I'm not moving out there to spend $900+ on a cart for myself. I'm buying the cheapest economy ticket I can. So I guess I'm going to be buttholes to L butts with everyone else in that train. Crap. Ah, oh, damn it. Well,
you're also okay. On the, like, going super fast on this very shaky rail that hasn't been, like, maintained in 30 years. And there's, like, very tall bridges. I guess you're not going through the mountains that much, so you won't be scared as a little boy like me.
No, I'm going through quite a bit of mountains, for sure.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. Just pray before you leave and pray when you get there, which is what I tell anybody for anything.
It's a 24-hour trip plus 8 more hours. It's going to be a long journey out to where I'm going.
Do you have to travel from here to get on the train?
Yes. I have to go to a city just north of us, get on the train, and then take the train all the way to where I'm going. It's going to be wild. I have to leave my wife, my family, all of my friends behind. People I will never see again. People that I'm leaving behind, I was already moving 2 months from now, but now I'm leaving everybody 2 months early and not even getting a chance to say goodbye to anybody. So pretty cool. Two shaka bras up to just uproot my life unexpectedly very quickly and to hell with everyone, apparently. Just kidding. I love all my friends and family and I'll miss you all dearly.
Well, sincerely from the bottom of my heart, goodbye.
Goodbye. Well, that seems like a great place to end this episode. Just kidding. Because we need to talk about, of course, 2014's Deadly Lessons or 2006's The Legend of Simon Conjurer. Now, I am sad that we have to end the show with this episode, or put the show on ice with this episode, because I was looking forward to next week doing Whomst Was the Simon Conjurer of The Legend of Simon Conjurer, but alas, that will have to wait until October when the Bagger Vance dies and Simon Conjurer takes his place.
It's truly bittersweet because it's bitter. We won't find out for a long time.
Bitter like
but man, it'll be so sweet to think about it for 3 months and really give him the ultimate Bagger Vance treat.
Yeah, give him the right answer. You know, like we fly by the seat of our pants, but now we got time to crunch the numbers and really think about whom's the Simon Conjurer of The Legend of Simon Conjurer was, and give him the correct answer, truthfully.
Yeah, I don't even know what I'm doing here. I feel like I'm flying by the seat of my pants. I feel like I've done something stupid, like call John Voight the Bagger Vance every week or some dumb, stupid thing.
Well, I think you were. I don't think you were ever wrong with that. I don't know, proclamation. I feel like you nailed it every single time. John Voight was definitely the Bagger Vance of every movie we watched so far. And I'm the dummy, because I'm the dummy man who had to figure out other options. You were correct every time you spoke.
Well, I also feel like I'm the dummy man, because I don't even remember picking John Voight every time. Like, I'm sure I picked the river once between Anaconda and Deliverance, right?
I think so. I think for both. Even for, like, you know, even for JL Family Ranch, you picked the river. Because the river, of course, supplies the water pump that James Caan was trying to steal from him.
And the river's always coming for you.
Oh, yeah. I can't wait to watch The River next year. Is that a movie with Alec Baldwin? I feel like that's a movie. Maybe I'm wrong.
I have to assume The River is definitely a movie, whether I've seen it or not, or it stars me. I have no idea.
I think it stars you, actually, now that I think about it. I already got IMDb open here. Let me just look and see if The River... I know that, like, I might be thinking of the Hatchet series. You remember Hatchet?
With the guy?
There is a movie called The River. It's from 1984. A farming family battles severe storms. A bank is threatening to repossess their farm. Oh, and there are other hard times in a battle to save and hold on to their farm. This sounds like a Cowgirl Summer movie that we should have watched. Damn.
It sounds like every plot to Cowgirl Summer.
It stars Mel Gibson and Sissy Spacek. Wow, what an all-star lineup.
Was Sissy Spacek super like right-wing Christian back then? Or hated Jewish people?
I don't know. I don't know what her deal was. She was hot off being Carrie, I guess.
Oh, she was hot off being Carrie. That makes a lot more sense.
Which has an ending very similar to Deliverance, where a hand pops out of a thing.
Oh, just like the Thing movie, where it comes out of the swamp.
Just like the Thing movie, where it comes out of the swamp. The Swamp Thing movie.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, we're not here to talk about Swamp Thing. We're here to talk about Deadly Lessons.
Tater Tots.
Exactly. Did you watch this on Tubi TV?
I did watch this on Tubi TV. What kind of commercials were you greeted with?
Zero. I have an ad blocker like an adult. I didn't see any commercials. All it did would stutter for a second, and I'd see a thing that was like, oh, we'll be right back. Nope. And then that would be gone, and I'd just get right back to the movie.
I feel like my computer would explode if I were to attempt such magistry. And speaking of magic, this movie is magic.
Oh, it's definitely magic. Or maybe it's Christian and holy. I don't know. There's a lot of an unexpected amount of talk of God and religion and all kinds of stuff that I was not expecting in this movie. Like nudity. Was not expecting that, but there's a bit of nudity in this movie.
Yeah, but the thing about the nudity is that it made sense. It was necessary for the plot continue.
It was completely justified, and I'm sure when the actress read that in the script, she was like, this makes sense. I'm glad that I have to do this, and I'm glad that I have to make out naked with the writer, director, star of this movie, Stuart Paul.
It's weird how many times it said, this is necessary in the description of the scene.
Well, and he looks into the camera while they're making out and goes, trust me, this is very necessary. And you go, well, I don't like that you had to say trust me first.
He does say something kind of akin to that when he's, like, looking her dead in the face, and she kind of has to go with it. It's a very gross scene.
Yeah, I mean, since we're talking about it, we might as well talk about how, like, his eyes throughout the movie are very just, like, blasé and kind of dull, but as soon as he has to look at a naked woman in a shower, he's got the hungry eyes of a predator. Like, he's just like, he's totally inflamed in that moment and fully alive, ready to pounce.
Yeah, it's almost like he has this very specific view of this character, how he wants to portray it. But then when pretty girls are on the scene, he just gets so horny and wistful, and he has to nut.
His eyes are bugging out in that scene. It's wild. It's like, bro, you can't even hide your excitement at seeing a naked woman. Ridiculous.
It's beautiful, though. It really shows the human condition, which I did not think John Voight or Simon Conjurer were human whatsoever.
Oh, my God. Well, we'll get to John Voight. But first, we need to talk about the nice Comic Sans opening font that starts off this movie. You know it's a good movie. You know it's a high-budget movie when Comic Sans is the font that they've chosen to write the opening. Not even credits, just like Crystal Sky Entertainment, which sounds like a BS company, and I think it is.
Oh, definitely a BS company. According to IMDb, this movie had a budget of $30 million.
I
don't think so.
No, it's all there on the screen. What are you talking about? You see every penny of that $30 million on the screen, especially in the face prosthesis and fat suit that John Voight wears throughout the movie.
Because of the Comic Sans and, you know, the visual display of this movie, I have to assume that this was made in 2006.
Yeah, oh, definitely made in 2006, yeah. It's, yeah, I did like that fact on the IMDb page, because it was in the questions and answers section of IMDb, and the question was, did this movie really cost $30 million? And the answer was, yep. I was like, all right, well, asked and answered, there you go.
Well, obviously, Simon Conjurer is on the IMDb boards. He's correcting everything.
Yep.
He wants people to get the right idea of this movie.
He wants IMDb to bring back their message boards, of course. So people can post posts on the Bonnie Hunt message board that say, like, why no nudes, Bonnie Hunt?
Which we need to know.
We need to know.
Definitely. It's a two-sided coin at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What did you think of the opening credits of this movie that weren't the Comic Sans fake production company credits?
Well, I thought something was going on with my TV at first, because there is a dark black period. And then the elementary school credits are great.
Yeah.
They're perfect.
They might be the best part of this movie, at least the most like creative, clever part of this movie, where all the credits are done diegetically, you could say, where all the writing is like on elementary school art hung throughout the building that we're in. That was pretty clever.
It was great. It was like I was getting started to watch Kindergarten Cop or something.
Yeah, and I went, there's $30 million on the screen right there. They had to buy all that arts and crafts supplies and write all the names on everything, except when it says, like, written and directed by on the blackboard, the name is, like, erased out.
Yeah, it's clever. It was a clever filmmaking choice, I think, by Mr. Stuart Gull. What is his name?
Stuart Paul, but he wrote, and so there's this thing I discovered researching this movie. There's very little information about this movie out there, but there is the fact that when this movie was coming out or getting ready to come out, they credited the director as Q Mark. And they were like, this is the big, who is this Q Mark? And then I was like, it's Stuart Paul. Who cares? He's nobody. He made a bunch of, like, he made, like, two movies, took a 17-year break, and then made this movie. But, like, a 27-year break, and then made this movie. But, yeah, that was, like, the big deal. Also, he's either, like, related to John Voight, or he's friends with John Voight, because he is the uncle of JL Family Ranch's Skylar Shea, a.k.a. John Voight's niece, but also this guy's niece. A weird connection amongst the whole family in there.
Well, it sounds like these two guys are definitely brothers with benefits.
Oh, truly, yeah. I would love to see them kiss naked in a waterfall together.
Because of the shooting of this movie, how it kind of all lays out, the characters and their places within the story, it felt very much like a play. Like, I feel like this guy wrote a bunch of plays and then somebody gave him an insane amount of money do a movie.
John Voight gave him an insane amount of money. Like, there's no way John Voight isn't involved in the financing of this movie, because he's, besides Skylar Shea, is the only recognizable name or face or anything in this. Although, the big fat guy in this movie looked kind of familiar, and I don't know where I might know him from, but he looks kind of familiar too. Do you know who I'm talking about?
Well, this film was shot in Kelowna.
Was it?
And I feel like I've seen so many of these people on commercials and general media through Haitian art.
If that's true, then that's buck wild. I don't know if that's true or not. I mean, some of them look kind of familiar. Oh, gosh, I don't know. I'm trying to quickly look up where I know that big guy from, but it's not. My internet's being bad, so it's being naughty. I will say, go ahead.
Well, I was so out of it when I watched the first scene. I eventually passed out and didn't watch the rest of the movie, but I had no idea what was going on in this in the first scene when all the kids are flying around. There's this woman that's a nurse. I couldn't catch hide nor hair of it.
I think you mean the MILF who's a nurse.
Right. You get this MILF walking down the hallways of this elementary school, and you just can't help but wonder what's under that skirt.
I mean, there is something about her. Like, I don't know. She looks sad, but she's kind of hot, too. I don't know. It's a weird thing. It's a weird feeling.
She definitely doesn't know how to fake closing her eyes, though.
No, I do love that, like, Simon Conjurer keeps, like, pointing at his eye going, like, close your eye, and now close your eye, and now close your eye.
And then she does, and then she just winks again, and is like, oh, no, I see you winking. You've got to close both of your eyes.
Okay, so the fat guy in this movie named Bulwark is, Not anyone I apparently know, but he is the voice of Piglet in, like, every piece of Winnie the Pooh media since, like, 2005.
Oh, motherfucker got Piglet? That's pretty cool.
He got the Piglet. He's doing Piglet in Kingdom Hearts. He's doing Piglet in Winnie the Pooh's Big Adventure. He's Piglet all over the place. That's way better than me and Tigger, I'll tell you that much.
Well, it's definitely better than this character, or not, because he probably got some sweet money out of this.
Oh, yeah. I guess. $30 million ready to go into Piglet's pockets.
I guess Piglet has its own, you know, esteem and money to be made.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So like Steve said, children are flying in this classroom. Simon Conjurer makes them close their eyes, and then they fly. And because they're scared to fly to New York, I guess they're all scared to fly to New York. And he's like... And when they land again, he's like, now see, it's not scary to fly, and now you can all fly with your parents to New York on September 11th, 2001. And they go, no problem, happy to do it. Thank you, Simon.
And you're introduced to the psychology of the mind and how beautiful Simon Conjurer just, like, orchestrates your brain into being a better person.
Yeah, he's a real mind freak. He's doing a lot of, like, sleight-of-hand magic, turning... globes into doves and doves into globes and pulling doves from behind children's ears and making doves fly. Very dove heavy magic show.
Yeah, you can definitely see the influences of Mind Freak and all his Vegas friends.
He takes that kid, he cuts her in half with a giant bandsaw, and everyone's like, whoa! And he keeps going, are you ready? And I think that's the hallmark of a cool Simon Conjurer.
Simon Conjurer, what did you think of the name of the man, Simon Conjurer?
Well, much like every name in this movie and the prosthetics on John Voight's face, it's very on the nose.
Yeah, the characters are on the nose. The plot is really on the nose. They feel like a jury in the back of a room, like all playing their parts and like weaving this story together, and not a very... It's just not good.
Like, this movie was written by a stupid idiot who thinks he's a real smart guy. Like, that's the easiest way to describe this movie, is someone who just goes like, yeah, I'm gonna write this movie that's gonna blow people's minds. And look, the girl who's sad is named Tears, and the kid who's a rebel is named Rebel, and the fat guy is named Fatty, and the guy with a plate in his head is named Platehead. Like, just such a stupid movie. It's such a stupid movie for stupid people. I loved it.
I love this. I probably really would have got sucked into this movie when I was like 20 years old. I'd be like, look how deep it is. It's talking about the like inner fabrics of society and like how we deal with each other and psychology.
Oh, you have deep mental scars and possibly schizophrenia? All you have to do is remember being held at knife point by a criminal and it'll cure it. No problem. It's so easy to get over mental health issues. You idiot, you cuck.
And it seems like they base all of these characters on the seven deadly sins, but there's nine of them.
There's ten of them.
And because there's, it makes it so when they, like, solve their own issues, you have to go through all of them throughout this movie, so you're not taking any time to get to know them or to understand the process of, like, getting well and figuring out your mental issues. It just hits them, and they're like, oh, yeah, I'm cured forever now.
Yeah, like they look in the mirror one time and go, oh, I remember my dad was a drunk and he had all the same bottles. He loved Hennessy, and then I drank because my dad loved drinking and I thought he'd love me if I drank, and then that's good. And then the gambler's like, hey, and I remember my thing. It's just like, bing, bing, boom, boom, boom. Easy peasy, figure it out. Simon Conjurer, you done it again.
Yeah, and they go out on this adventure, and some of these characters get triggered by something that's happening around them, and it's coincidental and mysterious or whatever. But some of them just read it in the book. Some of them are like, what's my thing? And then they just figure it out by reading it.
Right. So the premise of this movie is that Simon Conjurer is not called Conjurer. He's called Conjurer. They make a very clear point to say that every time. He's like a teacher, I guess, who teaches people how to heal from their traumas or whatever. And so he's got a class of 10 people that all get together, including the famous Rebel, Roberto Rebel. And he gives them all books that have exactly what's happening in the movie in them. Like, he gives them the script to the movie, essentially, right? That's kind of what it is.
It's all laid out. Their whole stories, what will solve them. The whole movie is laid out word for word in this plot. And you know he wrote that shower scene in those books. They're very aroused.
Well, you know he did because they're reading it going like, there's no way he's hooking up with her in the shower because Dr. Krazik's here to try to kidnap her and kill her. There's no way they're having sex in the shower right now. And then you come back and they're just fricking in the shower. And everyone's like, oh, rats. I can't believe that. Why would he do that? You dumb idiot. Dumb Simon Conjurer.
Oh, Ratzenberger. Oh. And if... Okay, spoiler alert. It was all made up, or they made up the story themselves and the books were blank. But
I guess.
Like, that doesn't... And they explain some of the things, but they don't explain why the shower scene is still in there. Like, that's still not explainable. They know it happened.
He does say to the woman, though, as they're about to hook up, he goes like, this will all make sense later. Like, he says something like that. Like, and then in the end, it doesn't make any sense.
No.
And they were also, like, together at one point. She's, like, his ex or something. But she's like, do you think about me? I think about you all the time. And he's like, well, sometimes I think about you.
Yeah, I get pretty horny as a conjurer.
Yeah, I get it from talking to kids to being real horny about my ex-wife and her smoking bod. Let's see those yabos. I guess the main draw of this movie, though, is John Voight wearing full face prosthesis and a fat suit and a red-haired wig and just acting like his life depended on it. Like, he is hamming it up so big in this movie for nothing. Like, he turns in the performance of a lifetime in a garbage nothing movie. Unbelievable, JV. We love you.
Well, he has to do it because he probably put in $40 million of this $30 million dollar budget.
Yeah.
And his niece's career is on the line. Hades on the line. They're really mad at him because they probably had to put in $10 million. I mean, his brother with benefits. He's got to make sure his career lasts. Which, somehow, Stuart Paul has found a niche directing and writing recently.
Yeah, he's made a bunch of movies, including a movie recently called, like, Vamp Daddy, starring Danny Trejo of Anaconda fame. So it's just, like, it's this weird cyclical thing where just the same people keep working in the same things. It's bizarre. Hollywood is effed and fricked, you might even say.
Just put your life and your soul into it and make a movie like Deadly Lessons and you'll be rich eventually.
I love thinking about John Voight having to put on this prosthesis every day for this movie. Just being in a fat suit, slamming down chocolate bars, hamming it up to the nth degree, and then this is what comes out of it. And he has to sit in the theater and go, oh man, he really filmed that sex scene in the shower, huh? Dang, I was really hoping that I talked him out of filming that, but here we are, it's in the movie, can't go back now.
Well, John Voight famously wanted to be in that shower scene. He wanted to be the shower.
Just coming out of his mouth.
I absolutely love John Voight in this movie. I had to do a lot of IMDb searching when I first was watching this movie because, like, the quality and the acting and everything didn't seem like something John Voight would be in. And he's not in it for a while, but then he comes in... just blazing with his chocolate.
Oh, yeah. Once John Voight enters the movie, it really kicks into a high gear, and then they get rid of him for, like, 80% of the movie. Like, I really thought that there was going to be more John Voight in this movie, considering he's number one on the call sheet. He's billed number one in the movie, even above Stuart Paul, writer, director, actor.
Yeah, Stuart Paul really crapped on himself when it came to... on the call sheet.
But that's what Frank D'Angelo does too, though, where he'll put everyone else above him and then he gets the last credit and starring Frank D'Angelo. But, you know, he'll put James Caan, he'll put, you know, Tony Nardi, he'll put Armando Sante, he'll put all kinds of Daniel Baldwin, all the famous actors that have worked with him in the past, Michael Paré, he'll put Robert Loggia, he'll put, you know, all kinds of actors and actresses. I'm blanking. I used to know them a lot better, but now I don't know them as well. But he's very humble that way, and same with Stuart Paul.
Oh, he's a saint. They're doing God's work.
Oh, yeah. What did you think of Rebel?
Rebel was great. I feel like there was no overacting whatsoever. I found the facial expressions and the way he talked very good.
And the way he moved and seemed to, like, be stuck to everything around him. How he had to, like, be hugging the front of the Hummer Simon Conjurer drives, or hugging the wall, or hugging the desk, or hugging Simon Conjurer. He was just stuck to everything.
Oh, you couldn't get away from him. He took over the stage and screen.
Oh, yeah, with his big fake smiles that don't reach his eyes, but they're big smiles, and his eyes look pained. He's very good. He's gone on to be in a bunch of things somehow. I don't understand how, but... And somewhere, some tween girl thinks he's the hottest thing to ever come out of Hollyweird, but she's wrong.
I could see a good actor in there somewhere. I feel like he, again, did a lot of plays and a lot of overacting on stage, and he transitioned that right to a movie, and it really didn't work for him. He was definitely evoking, like, a young Robert De Niro in his, like, facial expressions and his look, and it just doesn't come off genuine whatsoever.
Well, who's the Rebel Without a Cause guy? Who's the
James Dean.
James Dean. I felt he was trying to do a James Dean in this movie, and instead he was doing James Dean the porn star.
Definitely Hung Dong quite largely. Like, not literally, but you could see it in his pants.
Emotionally.
If you know what I mean.
Yeah, he emotionally Hung Dong through most of this movie. You know, during the sex scene in the show, we keep coming back to that scene, but it is the...
It's the whole movie.
It's the crux of the movie. It's the whole movie's building up to this sex scene in the shower. It's disgusting, and I hate it. But I fully expected Stuart Paul to hang dong in that scene. I was ready. I thought we were going to see an erect penis in that scene. Like, 100%.
I really thought he was going to go there. All the momentum of this entire scene, because it's so unnecessary in so many ways.
Yeah.
I thought he was going to hang dong or at least take his pants off. Because they're in that shower for quite a while getting it on.
Oh, yeah.
She's fully nude, having a beautiful shower under a waterfall. And he takes his shirt off, but not his pants.
Yeah, take your pants off, bro. Take off your pants and jacket.
Probably has a small dinger.
Yeah, that's probably it, right? Like, well, get a dong double. I mean, you got a butt double for when Tyr shows her butt, so get a dong double for you.
Such a beautiful shot when Tyr takes off her pants and shows her butt.
Well, according to Scorpio, who's got an anger problem, he goes, oh, she's got a butt like a black girl. And I went, nah, not, what do you mean? Like, not really.
Seems Latinx to me.
Yeah, I agree to disagree, Scorpio. How does that sound?
It was a nice bum. I paused it for a couple of minutes just to take her in.
Oh, yeah. What if I told you it was Stuart Paul's bum? How would you feel about that?
Great. If that's Stuart Paul's hand bum, good for him. Good for him.
You didn't see the Will Smith balls hanging down at the bottom of the bum?
No. I mean, Stuart Paul's in shape. He would have dimples on the side of his butt. In his iliac crest, you know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. She doesn't. She doesn't even have a kiss tattoo on her bum. Kids in Satan's service, of course.
Yeah, and the explanation for that is she just, like, loves being not real or something.
Yeah, the explanation for that is she has schizophrenia, which she cures by remembering a bad time she had once. This movie plays so fast and loose with mental health issues. It's wild. I love it.
Yeah, and the sexually confused man is a very weird story and a very weird lesson, and maybe, like, in the most insanely out of touch thing in this entire movie.
Yeah, so they go on the run. Simon Conjurer gets framed for murder by John Voight's character, I guess, somehow.
Child murder.
A child gets thrown off the roof of a building, and somehow Simon Conjurer gets blamed for that. I have no idea how. Explain, please.
So this is what I got out of the situation, is at the beginning, he's getting them to close their eyes and fly, right?
Yeah.
So they have gone home knowing that flying is super fun, so she... What they're saying is that she got up into a window, thought she could fly, and then threw herself out of the window.
Right, but that's that's not murder.
Well, it's Simon Conjurer's fault, especially when you have a beautiful doctor in Dr. Krazix?
Dr. Krazix, yeah. Who writes books about how suicide is cool. Like, that's John Voight's character. He's like, I'm a Pulitzer Prize winning author who writes books about suicide being dope as frick and why everyone should try it. And I go to book signings and I write, suicide is pretty cool in people's books. So good for him.
And that creates a natural enemy in Simon Conjurer because he wants to actually help people.
I guess. Yeah. And also, like, it turns out that John Voight has been a part of Simon Conjurer's life since he was a child, and also they've both been independently searching for proof of God, and both have found nothing to prove that God exists, and this makes them mortal enemies for some reason. I don't understand. This movie makes no sense. I love this movie.
There's a scene on the rooftop with Simon Conjurer and Dr. Krazix. And I don't know if that scene actually existed.
No, it's written. John Voight reads. John Voight is at a book signing, and then Dean Rockwell, or whatever the hell her name is, who is the chick who's naked in the shower with Simon Conjurer, she shows up and gives him a copy of the book that says, like, I know you murdered that child. And then he takes the book home. He is flipping open the book while speaking Latin, being like, versus Victa Verde, you know, whatever, Casa Grande.
Sanchez.
Banana phone. Yeah. And he spits a gob of chocolate into the air that lands on a page of the book that describes the scene, which I guess is like in the future. That, because this is a script for the movie, apparently, that in the future, him and Simon Conjurer are going to have a showdown on the roof of a building that he has, like, a built-in, gangplank. And he's going to make Simon Conjurer walk the plank off this building, I guess.
Successfully, because he does fall. And the falling scene is so realistic and beautiful.
I mean, I had written, like, the special effects look pretty good in this scene when they're on the gangplank. Where it's like then it's like a set with like a green screen underneath. I thought, oh, that actually looks pretty good. And then the second he falls off, I went, oh, this looks terrible. Oh no, this is bad.
Yeah, the roof unfolding to create the plank and everything. I thought that was genuinely kind of interesting. Weird. And then he falls off and you're like, what is happening?
Like, weird and dumb and unnecessary. Why do you need the roof to why do you need the railing of the roof to unfold into a gangplank for him to walk off of? This movie is written by a stupid person pretending to be smart. That's what it is.
If you watch this movie, which I pray that you do,
go to tubi.tv.
You'll understand why we're like having trouble finding like the words to express it or to go through the plot like in a linear way. Because like I looked at this movie once and then looked down at my notes. And look back at the movie, and I was like, what do I write? How do I encapsulate the craziness that is this movie? And it's mainly in the shower scene, but it's insane throughout this whole movie.
I mean, to go back to the gangplank scene for just a second, John Voight has a Dirty Harry-style Magnum gun that he's pointing at Simon Conjurer, a.k.a. his nephew or brother, whatever. It doesn't matter. He's pointing a gun at him, and then he's like, go and walk the plank. And then he reaches into the wall and pulls out, like, a pirate sword. And now he's holding a modern-day Cougar Magnum from GoldenEye and a pirate sword. And he's, like, threatening him with the sword and also pointing the gun at him. But it's like, you don't need both. Just give him one or the other. Why does he have both? It's completely unnecessary and beautiful and great, and I loved it.
Well, that's the thing. That's the whole thing with John Voight's character. You don't need to make him fat and pudgy, although you do need him to be the antithesis of Simon Conjurer, which is felt and beautiful and like everything a person could ask for in a partner.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, supportive and loving and magic, yeah.
Who's that guy that plays the flute that kind of looks like him? Not flute, but
Kenny G.
Yeah, Kenny G. He's got so much Kenny G vibes coming out of him.
I mean, coming out of his curly hair, he definitely does. Absolutely. He's Kenny G'd up.
Well, that was, you know, Kenny G's time, right? 2006, when he really prospered.
Mm-hmm. That was like the heyday of Kenny G, for sure. And Simon Paul.
Or Paul, yeah, it was on Fox Simon? News every day.
Oh, yeah. You want to know what my favorite line in this movie is so far in my notes? When the cops go to that dead little girl who's like 4 years old and they go, "Damn, I'm sick of murder, especially kid murder."
Yeah.
Classic.
I wrote that down last night and got it completely wrong, but I wrote it down again today, and it's a beautiful line because it's very wooden in its delivery, and it's too explicit for the scene.
And also, like, Dedoy, "Damn, I'm sick of murder, especially kid murder." Yeah, bro, we all are. We all are sick of kid murder. No one's like, "Oh, not enough kid murder for me."
Yeah, just take your pension and quit being a cop then.
Right? Probably the best thing about this movie, though, besides the shower sex scene in the waterfall, is when they're driving in the truck and they drive past a movie theater that's playing Master and Commander, and I was like, "Oh, hey, that's a movie I love. Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World. That movie's great."
When that come out? Because that really nails the timeline.
Like, probably 2006. 2005, 2006. That's a Russell Crowe.
Yeah, well, it has to.
It's a Russell Crowe, Paul Bettany
2003.
Classic. Okay, so, I mean, it would not surprise me at all if this movie was filmed in 2003, threatened to be released in 2006, and then was actually released in 2014 or whatever the hell it's supposed to be released.
Yeah, that timeline makes absolute sense. Mm-hmm. It's like, I wouldn't argue that at all.
So, Simon Conjurer is framed for murder of a child by Dr. Krasix, a.k.a. John Voight. So the class reads this in the magic book and goes on the run with Simon Conjurer to prove that he's innocent, even though, like, you read it in the book, and, like, if he's innocent, it doesn't matter. Like, it'll be fine. He'll sort it all out. But they go on the run, and they break into Dr. Krasix's house to look for evidence that he's guilty of murdering a child.
Well, you gotta go right to the source. And Dr. Krasix's apartment is definitely worth this whole movie.
Oh, yeah.
It is a beautiful display of architecture and design.
Oh, yeah. They got a big snake enclosure right in the middle of the foyer. There's Egyptian symbolism all over the walls. There's a friggin' sarcophagus with a mummy in it just tucked away in the corner. Like, there's a room that's just the Library of Alexandria, I guess. They keep referring to it as that.
A kitchen that's very torture-centric with a lot of metal and hanging hooks. And
there's a whole wall of microwaves. One wall is just full of microwaves for some reason.
That I got. That made sense to me. I'd like to have an apartment with a microwave wall.
Why not, hey?
Why not?
You haven't been drinking nearly enough wine.
I drank my whole glass. I'm nasty. I'm with it.
You're a Simon Conjurer.
I am a Simon Conjurer. That's what they all say about me.
I did like when they get to the Library of Alexandria and the gambling addict, who they keep referring to as a degenerate gambling addict, which is like, that's kind of mean. You don't have to call him a degenerate. You can just call him by his name, Platehead, or Crack. I guess he also goes by Crack. But he like reads from a book and goes, "Listen up, children, and you will hear about all the good stories written in here." I'm like, that's a bad rhyme. That's an ugly rhyme, bro.
Great delivery, bad rhyme. He comes off very nice, though. Like, throughout this whole movie, his lines are like of a genuinely smart, fun individual. And I'd like him to be my uncle godfather.
He lost his teeth in a poker game and won them back in a craps game. But then it turns out they're not his teeth. He doesn't care. He puts them in anyway.
Well, they wouldn't fit, though. That's crazy to me. As a man with dentures, that's crazy to me.
Well, fair enough, yeah. They're, like, looking through all the religious texts. Like, he's got everything from, like, pre-Mesopotamia writings and, like, other stuff. And then the last one he, like, refers to is writings of the Reverend Tweak Delzano. That's pretty cool. And that's not a real person. I Googled him. That's not a real person. I don't know who the Reverend Tweak Delzano is, but he's not real. Or even fictional. Yeah. He's nothing.
But it really rounds out his character and his discussion of religion.
It makes me think that he's just lying the whole time. It makes me think that he's pulling this out of his arse, his gambling arse.
Well, you do find out that that is the case.
Yeah, the resolution to his problem is like bull-ass, right? Like he's lying to them when he says he's cured of his gambling addiction, right?
Well, I don't know. He does eventually win the lottery and give all his money away.
Does he?
Yeah.
Okay, here's the thing. Full disclosure, with 10 minutes left in this movie, Tubi TV was like, you're not connected to the internet anymore. You can't watch this movie anymore. But I was connected to the internet, and I refreshed the page several times, and it kept going, nah, you're not connected to the internet. And I went, I have other pages open that I'm currently scrolling. I am connected to the internet. And they went, we assure you, you're not. So the last thing I saw was when that woman was levitating in the hospital room. That's the last thing I saw in the movie.
Yeah, and I think the only thing that happens after that is they show them in a gas station, and all their tickets turned out to be winners, and he bought a ticket to the big lotto before he renounced his gambling addiction and won $31 million and gave it all away. The end of a movie.
Ugh, bad. Listen up, children. You will hear about all the good stories written in here.
It's a beautiful tale. I feel like that summarizes the whole movie. There's so many obvious, like, through lines to these characters that are not inventive and not fun at all, and they resolve themselves without any character progress or building. It's wild. It's all for that shower scene.
Yeah, I mean, for instance,
that's it.
Skylar Shay is an anorexic, although they call her an anorexic, but her whole thing is she pukes all the time, so she's actually bulimic, but it doesn't matter. But she just starts to eat for no reason. She starts eating donuts and goes, goodbye, skinny bones. Hello, poundage. You know, all right. Does that mean that you're going to get fricked all over town? Is that what you're saying?
Well, big poundage, I think. She wants to get some weight on her and then go traipse through the town as the town bicycle, of course.
Oh, yeah. Now she'll have cushion for the pushing.
I think this Stuart Paul man is her father. You found out that it was niece.
He's her uncle, yeah. But still, I mean, John Voight is her uncle. So, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, Bob's her uncle.
As far as I'm concerned, you can't have two uncles, so somebody's lying.
That's true, yeah. I think she's John Voight's daughter, and he often goes, well, even in this movie, she talks about having a crush on Simon Conjurer, her uncle, in real life, and talks about how she only helped him because she had a crush on him, and then when his like ex-wife shows up and they start making out in front of everybody, she goes, well, I guess crush over. It's like, that's your uncle, bro. Like, your uncle wrote this movie, and he wrote that line into it. That's weird, right? Like, that's uncomfortable for you at family reunions, right?
I feel like you see the full display of old white men taking advantage of their power and their position in Hollywood in full display throughout this entire movie, because it doesn't make any sense. He casts this young, beautiful person to be his love interest and forces her into a shower scene where she has to be naked, and he doesn't even have to take off his pants.
Very naked. It's beautiful. Mm. I love it. What did you think of the detectives in this movie?
I thought they were great. I feel like they could have been more doofusy, a little bit more clanky, like a cartoon.
I liked them as well. I thought they were like ugly and funny throughout the whole movie. Like when everyone's in Dr. Krasick's house, and then like the doorknob starts rattling, and they go, "Oh, we have to hide." So everyone hides, and then it's just the cops breaking into their house, like breaking into his house, and they don't have a search warrant or anything. So like anything they find is not going to be admissible in court, but whatever. And then the head detective goes like, yeah, those are my detective instincts that got me in here. They've never been right. In all my years on the force, they've never been right. And that made me laugh. And then the door starts rattling again, and the cops go, "We have to hide." And so they hide as well, and that made me laugh too. And like that little sequence with the cops and everyone hiding in Dr. Krasick's house was very enjoyable.
Maybe that's why he's had so much success with his most recent films, because he's finally figured out how to write, expand on the dummy cock idea to the whole movie, because that was a little bit of a bright spot throughout this whole thing.
Yeah, it was like the lone bright spot, besides the shower scene, of course.
And the globe. I think the globe stuff was number one.
It's beautiful, yeah. What about when the drug addict figures out her problem, which was that when she was 7 years old, she was in the backseat of the car and her dad ran over a kid on a bicycle and just kept driving?
Yeah, this was one of the heights of the moments where I was like, just because you figure something out doesn't mean you're cured forever. Like, yeah, you suddenly remembered your dad running over a little girl and driving
killing her.
But now you have that in your mind. Won't that make you more insane?
Yeah, you wouldn't just be like, well, like, because she even says, like, I looked back out the back window and she wasn't moving. I knew she was dead. And, like, that's what she remembers all of a sudden. So wouldn't you now have the bad part? You have the image of a 7-year-old girl run over by a car in your head. I hate murder, especially kid murder.
But the drug addict loves kid murder because it solves her drug addiction.
Yeah, so I can't trust anyone, not even myself, which is why I'm addicted to drugs. All right, sure, why not? Fine.
Cool. And that really is just everybody's story, is them, like, looking back and, like, most of them are in their childhoods that they figured out some kind of damage happened to them and now they're fine.
I mean, Scorpio's dad used to beat him while his grandpa beat his dad at the same time, which is weird.
That was a good scene.
Good scene. Real funny stuff. Like, he barely gets beat and then his dad gets the hell beaten out of him by his grandpa. So really, where's your trauma from, bro? I don't know. Not from that.
Yeah, stop holding it all in. Yeah. Become an MMA fighter.
What did you think of the scene where John Voight rubs a giant stone penis on a statue and then it opens up and he pulls a gun out of it?
Well, I saw The Hinge, so I kind of spoiled it for myself.
That's fair.
I was very horny because I was looking at that, like, limp peener in bronze, beautiful bronze. I thought it was the most significant scene of the whole movie, I thought.
Oh, absolutely. Correct. 100%. Very significant. It's all about what the movie is, which is Simon Conjurer stroking himself off, essentially.
It's probably where most of the money went to, is building that apartment, because I couldn't imagine anybody having those statues or apartment in one singular containment.
Well, that's John Voight's real house that they filmed in. I don't know if you know that, but that's where John Voight lives. He's got a wall of microwaves and everything.
Yeah, that's where Skylar Shea grew up.
I thought she grew up on the JL Family Ranch.
Yeah, both can be true.
That's true.
Summers in ranch, evenings in the city.
Yes. You know, I take back what I said was my favorite line. This is my actual favorite line. When Simon Conjurer and his ex are having sex in the waterfall shower, she goes, I'm so wet.
Like, you're forcing this woman to say, I'm so wet, while you're, like, cupping her butt.
Yeah, she literally goes, have a feel, giving him consent in case he has to go to court. She gave him consent in the movie to cop a feel of her buttocks, and he does. It's so gross. It's so gross.
You can't write in consent. And, this journey to his ex's house is just so unnecessary. It doesn't solve anything.
No.
It's other than his boner. Which we don't see. He doesn't even get his rocks off. He's driving in a truck full of C4.
You're absolutely right. I forgot about that. Yes, well, we don't have time to get into the truck full of C4. We don't have time to explain that.
It's crazy.
But so then, at the end of the movie, who cares? At the end of the movie, everyone goes back to the school where they started, and all the books are empty, and everyone's mad at Simon Conjurer over that. They're like, why are these books empty? But they're all healed of their trauma. But they still are like, this is bull-ass that these books are empty. It's like, well, but who cares? Who cares with these books? Like, magic's been happening all night. Now the book is empty via magic and you're mad about it? It doesn't mean anything. It's fine.
Also, duh. Like, of course the book is empty. Well, everybody could see that from the beginning.
Yeah, exactly. Well, not these dumb idiots. Not these 10 doofuses.
But they all still believe. They all test themselves. Yeah, to make sure that they're still healed.
Take a pill.
And that's the best part.
Drink a drink. Just kidding. Try to eat a big hero sandwich. Just kidding. Although my favorite is the horny kid who wants to hug Skylar Shea. And so he hugs her and she's like, okay. And he hugs her and she goes, don't get an erection though. She literally says, don't get an erection. He hugs her and picks her up. And she like kind of kisses him on the cheek. And then she pulls back and he straight up kisses her on the lips. And she looks genuinely shocked that he did that. Like, she's like, what the hell? Like, you could see her being like, what the hell? She pulls back in, like, fear and shock, and then he puts her down, and it's a beautiful scene. But, like, I really think he crossed a line, and they went, keep it in the movie, it's fine.
Yes, which happens throughout this movie, but that's the most explicit point. And it's, like, to show that he has control over his sexuality and who he is in that regard, but then he goes beyond and kisses the girl, and he's not supposed to, so it definitely... It's something, as an editor or a director, you could take that part out and just show the hug. But he's so horny. Stuart Paul is just so horny. Oh, he had to leave it in.
He's so horny. He writes in a subplot where his niece has a crush on him. That's how horny he is. Everyone friggin' loves this guy. They all want to frick him, including the MILF nurse at the start and every female character, including, like, what's the description of the alcoholic woman? Oh, what is it? It's really good. It's, like, really, really funny. It's, like, oh, crap. I'm not going to be able to find it here.
Dummy Man.
It's Dummy Man. I'll cut this out, but it's all good. I'll find it here.
This is a classic leave-in situation.
That's true, yeah. Andrea is her name. Or Andrea. Andrea. Pretty and pretty worn out. It's a pretty, pretty mean thing to say about her.
Oh, mid-30s, just done with life.
Just rode hard and put away wet, Andrea.
Yeah, I love how they describe an old haggard drunk as in their mid-30s. Like, that's not old enough to, like, be that out of it.
Like, she's younger than you, and they're like, ah, she's pretty and pretty worn out. She's busted.
Well, we don't get to see her butt. I'm surprised they didn't, like, the writer of this movie didn't make every woman show their breasts and the butt.
Once Tears showed her butt, I was like, we're going to see every woman naked in this movie. We're going to see every woman, at some part of them naked at some point. And we did, except for Skylar Shea, because I figured the uncle wouldn't do that to her. But, like, I fully expected the drunk to, like, flash somebody or something like that. But, I mean, we did get Dr. Elkwood just showing her completely naked body in the shower unnecessarily.
Unnecessarily.
That's
for
true,
sure.
Yeah. So then at the end, it's revealed that Rebel's dad, who we all thought was dead, is actually alive, and he's the richest man in Los Angeles, and he's, like, the biggest contributor.
Yeah, his whole thing throughout this movie is his dad's dead, so he's suicidal and having, like, a terrible life. And it turns out he was alive the whole time, and Rebel was just putting on a prank or something.
And Rebel knew. And Rebel maybe hypnotized Simon Conjurer before the movie began.
Yeah. Like, it's implied that there's this whole mysticism, and maybe Rebel was, like, the conjurer of them all.
Right.
Yeah.
But then, I don't know. Simon Conjurer gets a note that just says, like, you follow your hypnotic conditioning. And he's like, okay, I guess,
man. What a film.
Oh, what a film. Well, should we wrap up Dr. Krasick's plot real quick? He shows up to arrest Simon Conjurer, but then the cops show up with Rebel's dad, who says he was flying a helicopter and saw John Voight throw a little girl off the roof of a building.
And they show it. They show the scene. They could have just said it. But, like, you don't look up at this helicopter once, or, like, maybe don't throw a child off a roof when there's a helicopter right above you?
Yeah, like, he's, like, carrying this child, and there's clearly a helicopter spotlight on him, and he's just like, I'm gonna I'm gonna throw her off the roof, F it. And it's the same roof of the building that him and Simon Conjurer fought on at the end of the book that they read. So,
yeah.
I don't know, man. This movie is a dumb movie written by a dumb person thinking they're smart.
Yeah, and it comes out in an absolutely beautiful fashion. I think everybody in the world should see this movie.
Me too. I love this movie. I thought it was great. And if this is the end of John Voight's summer, which it is, I'm so happy this is the movie we're going out on and not X-rated Midnight Cowboy, which I kind of was hoping would be the last movie we watched, but that's okay. This one's great too.
Yeah, this puts a really good button. I think it encapsulates this whole crazy summer that we've been under, and it's just such a good movie to watch. If you like movies like The Room and like other movies that are just absolute insanity, you have to see this movie, and it's little known. I don't think anybody knows about this movie.
No, it's such an underappreciated crazy garbage movie that you 100% have to watch it. It's 2.5 hours long. We should also mention that it's a slog. It's a real slog, but oh boy, is it fun when it gets when it's fun. It's whenever John Voight is on the screen, it lights up, and you just I mean, I feel like we've barely talked about John Voight in this whole episode, but it doesn't matter because he's whenever he's on screen, he's electric.
It is true that like compared to all the wooden acting and like just everything that is happening in this movie, you can still see that John Voight is like a great actor. Like he puts everything into it, and it like it's an insane character. The makeup and the script, everything about it is wrong, but he still doesn't pull it off, but he does it.
Oh yeah, he goes for it big time. Yeah. He's definitely going for it. He's putting on a masterclass of acting in this movie, and prosthesis work, of course, in that nose and that face. Why does he have to have those prosthesis? It's like it's barely enough of a change to warrant the change. It's still John Voight. It's not like he's playing Dick Cheney or something and needs to transform how he looks. He's just playing a guy who is not real. I love it though. I admire him. He's a master of the craft, and what a treat John Voight's summer in all 6 weeks of it has been.
It's been an absolute delight. I hope somebody gives John Voight a crazy amount of money so he can keep doing his movies like this. I want more.
Oh, I want more Stuart Paul excuses to hook up with naked chicks in showers. That's what I want. It makes me want to watch. Stuart Paul made like a movie in the 80s. He made a movie in the 90s, like that he acted in, and he directed both of those. And then there was like I said, a 26-year gap, and then this movie, and then one more movie. And I kind of want to watch all those movies just to see if they were excuses for him to creep on women, which this movie 100% was. This movie was 100% an excuse to be like a cool Jesus figure in a movie and also hook up with naked chicks. 100%. So I'm curious to see what the rest of his filmography looks like.
Yeah, he doesn't do a lot for so long. And then Alien Pandemic coming out 2022. Vamp Father 2022.
Can't wait.
Blind Ghost 2021.
Can't wait.
And Dollface 2021. He's found his niche, and he's raking it in now.
Oh, yeah. And now, I wonder if he stars in those movies, and I wonder if there's scenes where he hooks up with hot chicks in them.
I can only assume, but he might be too old-fathered now.
Well, yeah, he's like 20 years older than he was when he played Simon Conjurer, but I guess we'll see.
How do you let go of Simon Conjurer, though? You gotta put him in every movie.
Hoomps was the Simon Conjurer of every movie is what we'll be asking from here on in.
I think maybe we should, actually.
Well, Steve, what did you think of The Legend of Simon Conjurer, a.k.a. Deadly Lessons?
I thought this was such a like needle in a haystack. I can't believe that we just went through John Voight's IMDb, found this weird little movie that nobody knows about, and it turned out to be just insanity on film. I absolutely loved it. Now, Adam, what did you think of this film that we watched?
I loved it. I thought it was the right kind of low budget trash, and I would suggest,
yeah,
by low budget I mean $30 million budget. All up there on the screen, you see it all in John Voight's prosthetics. But if you can get a group of people together who are willing to stomach 2.5 hours of absolute trash, go to Tubi.tv, T-U-B-I.tv, and type in Deadly Lessons 2014 and watch this movie, and you'll have a great time.
Yeah, you're going to love it.
You're going to love it.
Why
not? And, you know, it's been a real pleasure, and I'm sad we have to take 3 months off, but until October, I love you.
I love you.
We love you,
please.
The best thing about being
crying music.
Is getting to have a cowgirl summer.
Can't wait for the end. So sad.
This
is the long episode. We really went in on this movie.
Podcast. God told us to change. So for the summer we're watching cowgirl flicks. Get in the action. Feel the attraction. Horses and teens are what a dream. Wanna be free, free to ride some horses.
Man, I feel like a cowgirl.
This was our John Moore theme song.
Good boy.